Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, with the historic changes in the House of Representatives, what can we expect from the Congress and President in policy and investigative battles? How will the power struggles play out? Will the Supreme Court weigh in? And if so, how? We have four top scholars with us. Andrew Rudulovich is the Thomas Brackett Reed Professor of Government at Bowdoin College. He's the author of Managing the President's Program, Presidential Leadership and Legislative Policy Formation, and also The New Imperial Presidency. George C. Edwards is also with us. He is a University Distinguished Professor Emeritus of Political Science and the Jordan Chair in Presidential Studies at Texas A&M University. His books include On Deaf Ears, The Limits of the Bully Pulpit, The Strategic President, Persuasion and Opportunity in Presidential Leadership, and Predicting the Presidency, the Potential of Persuasive Leadership. Mark Peterson is with us. He is Professor of Public Policy and Political Science in the Department of Public Policy's Luskin School of Public Affairs, and also Professor of Law at UCLA School of Law. He's the author of Legislating Together, The White House and Capitol Hill from Eisenhower to Reagan. He's also the editor of Healthy Markets, The New Competition in Medical Care, and he's co-editor of the volume Institutions of American Democracy, the Executive Branch. Sean Theriault is a professor in the Department of Government at the University of Texas, Austin. He is the author of The Power of the People, Congressional Competition, Public Attention, and Voter Retribution, Party Polarization in Congress, and The Gingrich Senators, The Roots of Partisan Warfare in Congress. So welcome to the Scholar Circle. It's great to have you all here with us to talk about our current political situation in the United States. I'd like to start with the overall government and our current situation in a sort of historic context. So we've got this brand new Congress, dare I say a corrupt president, highly divided and polarized Congress. Do we have a historical equivalent? George Edwards, how would you characterize it?
To get the level of polarization, we'd have to go back to the Reconstruction period after the Civil War. Civil War is pretty much by definition are polarizing events. As far as having a divided Congress, of course, that is nothing new. And in more modern times, it's typical. So for a president to lack a unified government, it's not an unusual challenge, but it always is a challenge, and it certainly is now. And the more polarized the government and we are historic highs, the more difficult the challenge is, particularly under divided government. I would add that this president, I think, is unique in many ways, one of which is his breaking norms of civility, of integrity. He's easily the most mendacious president we've ever had by far. I would say that he's the most impulsive as well, and probably most poorly informed. So it really is a lethal combination in terms of actually trying to govern and get something done and get something done in the most rational way.
Sean Theriault, I want to bring you in on this, given your work on polarization especially, and also given the comments that George just made about the president. I wonder, would you tie this sort of lack of civility and polarization in part to the work you did on Gingrich in the Senate?
Certainly Newt Gingrich really transformed the Republican conference and the House of Representatives. And of course, those folks who went from the House to the Senate, as I make the argument in the Gingrich Senator's book, they transformed the Senate. So there's no doubt that we're still kind of playing out the whole Gingrich style of politics, where you start questioning people's motives and you start questioning their credibility and their morality in a way that is really unprecedented. Now, we can certainly go back in history and we can point to particular people and particular cases, but it's never been as widespread as it is today. And part of the reason it's so widespread today is because of the politics that Newt Gingrich practices and also the success that he has. I mean, the guy is a backbencher. He joins the Republican leadership and eventually becomes Speaker of the House. So the American public had lots of opportunities to kind of slap down that style of politics, and instead they rewarded it.
And they've rewarded it all the way up to the presidency now. So I guess back to that question, which is that the one of the main sources that you see, like Americans rewarding Newt Gingrich and then it carrying all the way into having this guy, Donald Trump, in the presidency? I mean, look, I certainly think that there are other factors.
For sure. It's not just Newt Gingrich and a direct arrow to Donald Trump. I mean, along the way, we have people like Ted Cruz, who promises that he's going to go up to Washington and transform the way the place works. And indeed, he does. In Texas voters, of which I am one, we had the opportunity in a Republican primary. We could vote for Ted Cruz, who promised that style of politics, or David Dewhurst, the lieutenant governor at the time, who had every bit the conservative bona fides as Ted Cruz, but was going to go up there and do business. And the Texas voters said, no, we want someone to shake it up. And so, right, we can certainly blame particular politicians, but at every step of the way, the American voter has been there reinforcing and rewarding that kind of politics.
Mark Peterson, I'm going to bring you into this one. This is just a thought that I've had swimming in my head, which is, you know, the policies we know from other political scientists' work have been sometimes across the board favored by Americans, but a lot of times they tend to benefit the very wealthy and have for quite a long time. And in the process, we've seen, of course, the economic polarization as well. Do you think that part of this electing, you know, Newt Gingrich or Donald Trump has been, you know, I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take it anymore?
I don't think that applied to Newt Gingrich so much. We have to remember that Gingrich never ran for before voters any larger than his House district in Georgia. But then he rode building a coalition, a Republican coalition in the House to become Speaker. And he also, I think, to follow up on what Sean said, what was interesting about him or pernicious about him is turning this kind of politics into an explicit strategy. We've had nasty people before. We've had people who might have broken some norms of civility, but this was really an articulated strategy. Frank Luntz was very involved in developing the language and vocabulary for doing it. And what I think has transpired since then is not only having set that foundation, but having had a transformation of the methods of communication, the development of social media, how that has dissipated a general sense of norms about civility in general. And then you get to Donald Trump, who doesn't do this as a strategy. This is who he is. This is how he has conducted his life from the very beginning. And so he comes in and rides that wave. And the part of the wave he rode was his sense that there was a large part of the country, not a majority, but a large part of the country, that felt that Washington politics was not paying any attention to them, was not serving their interests and their needs, was not hearing them. And the very kind of discourse that had become a civil discourse, including what they felt was a very heavy-handed political correctness, he just broke right through. And the way he was able to do that was not just by being Donald Trump, not just capturing this moment, but having had this very unique attribute of having been constructed in reality television. And that construction on The Apprentice, he was, in a way, he was not well regarded in New York as a major entrepreneurial figure. He had been financially successful, but of course from a foundation of his father's wealth. But The Apprentice exposed him and his kind of bar brawl style to a swath of the American public who found that very refreshing.
So let's go back to the original question, which is putting our current situation into a historic context. Andy Radulovich, what would you add?
Well, I think I would say that a lot of the tools that President Trump has tried to use are not brand new tools, right? Some of the questions of executive authority that have been invoked by the current administration, the tools themselves are new. Obviously, the policies he's proposing, well, they're not necessarily new, but they're new to the mainstream. They're certainly new to becoming priorities of an American president. Even the current debate over the issuance of a national emergency, which, you know, I think few people find that to be substantively credible, but, you know, there have been numerous national emergencies declared on economic grounds across the years, and Congress set up a process by which that could happen. So I guess I would say, you know, what we're seeing here in a way is a bad combination. Congress having over the years delegated to the executive branch lots of its powers with the assumption that there would be, you know, sort of the moderate use of that or the rational use of discretion. Add to that then a president who is not willing to work within the system, hardly the great negotiator that he claimed during the campaign or during his business career, and so unable to get results out of even a unified Congress, much less the new divided one. You know, he's turned to these tools and is using them in pretty aggressive ways.
He reminds me a bit of a cornered animal, just lashing out.
Well, he's certainly a lasher, and Twitter allows that, of course.
Right. So there have been a lot of questions in the media about presidential power, limitations of presidential power. And I know that, George, you and Andrew both study presidential power. So I thought perhaps what we should do is talk about how the process has changed in the United States, how presidents have gained more power over time. How did that happen? And then how far can it go? George Edwards, what would you say?
Well, to begin, I'm going to challenge just a bit of the premise. Presidents have certain powers, and Andy is an expert at that. And then presidents try to exercise power, and that's not quite the same thing. For example, President Trump, despite all his promotional skills and his vast experience at promoting himself and his brand, has not been able to govern by winning public support for his policies, even policies that would seem to be slam dunks, such as a tax cut, which is not generally a politician's nightmare. But he hasn't been able to win public support for that. He hasn't been able to win public support for health care reform, despite the fact that before he became president, Obamacare was not popular. It's more popular now once he became president and tried to get rid of it. He's not been able to win public support for his immigration policies. The public does not support the wall in whatever version he seems to be talking about at the moment. Public support for international trade is pretty substantial. So those are primary issues. And he's not been able to govern in that fashion. He's not been able to govern as an effective leader of Congress. He's not been persuasive. He's not been an effective closer. He's not been an effective negotiator. I mean, we saw last night, one could imagine him saying to Congress, well, let's split the difference on border security and give me a little flexibility in there. Or one could imagine him saying, well, all right, I will give you something. I will give you protection for the Dreamers. And that has come up before. One could imagine doing something like that. And so everybody gets something and everybody can declare victory. But he hasn't been doing that. That has not been his approach at all. And so I think it's just an example of, one, his incompetence as a negotiator, as a leader of Congress, but also his inability to lead Congress and his inability to lead the public. Now, there certainly has been a growth in certain ways of presidents exercising powers. And actually, I think I would just defer to Andy to speak about that, since he really is an expert on it.
Well, I would just add in, I think George is absolutely right. There's a difference between the ability to influence governmental outcomes and, you know, the formal powers of the presidency. They're related, of course, and can be reciprocal in some ways. But on the whole, I mean, I would wholly agree with George's separation of the two. I guess I would say that if you are not able to use your broader skills in the office to get what you want, then you are going to wind up relying on the formal powers of the office. And so coming back to your original question, in some sense, the executive power grows with the executive branch, right? As you have a larger and larger administrative state, then the administrative powers of the president become more important. They are able to be exercised over more areas of life, right? So as the size and scope of American government grows, almost necessarily, so does the authority of the president. And this is aided, as I hinted earlier, by Congress's willingness, sometimes for quite good reasons, to grant discretion to the executive branch over the exercise, you know, of regulation, of, you know, how laws can be implemented. And so presidents, if they're smart about this, can use the power of appointments. They can use executive orders or other mechanisms to direct agencies to implement the law in a way that's consonant with their preferences. And again, as government does more, that's provides more influence over more areas of American life. I would add, though, that Congress has also given up powers that are directly delegated to Congress in the Constitution, the power to declare war, for example, or the powers over international trade. And again, there's some efficiencies, perhaps, in Congress, you know, handing over much of tariff power to the president, but you see the result in the Trump administration inventing effectively a national security justification for tariffs against our allies. That's in the law. There is a national security exemption in the powers that the Congress gave to the president. They did not, I think, expect a president to come along and use that power to, you know, to harm Canada.
If I could have had two things, Maria. One is George and Andy have hit the nail on the head across the board on those issues. But the two points I want to make very quickly is, one, Donald Trump would have he's been terribly unsuccessful in Congress. And the only reason he's had any success at all is because of the unity of the Republican Party in Congress. They have been willing to remain silent about the most obnoxious things he does, and they've carried forward on judicial nominations and on the tax bill. And otherwise, he wouldn't have had anything if we'd gone back to the party system of 30 years ago. The second thing is that Trump has really demonstrated something that both George and I have written a lot about, which is the president matters at the margin. But that margin to matter requires, it turns out, a president who actually knows something about policy issues he's talking about, and also know something about the institutions in which he's working. Even Ronald Reagan, who was often thought to be challenged in some of these issues of expertise and knowledge, was quite competent as a former governor of a very large state, and he was able to sit down with Tip O'Neill, the speaker from the other party in the House, and at the when the last T's needed to be crossed and I's dotted, he and Tip O'Neill could get together and work through that because Ronald Reagan had enough proficiency and capability as a president to make those negotiations happen. Ironically, Donald Trump, the art of the deal, Donald Trump, is completely incompetent as a president in those terms because he has neither the policy knowledge nor the institutional knowledge to make it work.
Perhaps that's a good thing.
Well, that depends, of course, on one's ideological orientation. But frankly, it may prove good in the end that we've had this experiment, and no longer will such an individual be allowed to rise into this position. But there is real danger to the American democracy and to government that for some period of years we're going to have this experience. One of the things that's happened is people have completely lost confidence in the capacity of government to do things and to be rational. And if you can't even, if you have a president of the United States for the first time in American history, pridefully takes ownership of shutting down the government, that is the most irresponsible act that a chief executive of a country or a state or a province could possibly do. And now people simply lost faith that this government has a capacity to do anything to solve any problem.
You're listening to The Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're talking with four distinguished professors about the power of the presidency and the new Congress and what might transpire. I might add to that, though, that, you know, we've got a sizable portion of the United States that is just anti-government, and they're cheerleading something like this on. And these, I suspect, are Donald Trump's core voters, because that rhetoric has been going on, you know, with Reagan and through the right-wing media for quite some time, that the government is the enemy. So I suppose most people don't even understand what government does. Sean Theriault, you've been quiet for a while. Let's bring you in.
That's right. You had all those presidency scholars talking about the presidency. The one thing that I would add is that Congress doesn't get a free check here. At any point, Congress can pass a bill and force the president to veto it. There's a reason that Mitch McConnell isn't taking up the bills that the House is passing. And that's because those Republican senators would have to decide to do what they think is right for the country, which would automatically put them against the majority of the voters in any Republican primary in any of those states that they represent. And so Mitch McConnell is the, I don't want to call him a genius here, but he is saving so many Republican senators right now, up until the point at which the American public has had enough and forces them to take a vote and actually put a bill on Trump's desk that he is going to have to either sign or veto. And then he will own, right, the shutdown at a level that he doesn't quite yet.
Sean Theriault, what have we seen go through? Are things going through the Congress?
No, there aren't. They are going through the House of Representatives. And what Mitch McConnell has said is he's not going to take up a single bill unless he knows it has support of the president. And what he's doing there, right, he's saving a little bit of efficiency, I guess you could say, and not putting things to the process that are ultimately going to be vetoed. But much more importantly, he's saving those Republican senators from doing what is clearly the right decision for them to do, from a majority of the constituents that would vote in a Republican primary, because a majority of those folks still support the president. Even if his approval rating gets down as low as 35 or 30%, it's still a majority of the voters in a Republican primary. And that's who these Republican senators are concerned about. So the House is passing these individual appropriations bills. They're passing them as a package. They're even setting apart the Homeland Security portion of it. There are multiple paths in which the government could be open later this afternoon. But until Mitch McConnell calls those bills up on the Senate floor, there's no chance of them going to the president's desk.
What do you predict on that, Sean Theriault?
You can't predict in this world anymore because of Donald Trump. 2 weeks ago or 3 weeks ago, we had a deal in the Senate. That the Senate passed it unanimously. The president pulls the support and it dies. So when he decides one thing 1 hour and the next thing another hour, we can't make predictions. I mean, what I will predict is as soon as the American public feels this shutdown, then it's going to collapse in a heartbeat. But I don't know how much they're going to feel before they ultimately force the Congress and the president to get on the same page and to get the government back open.
Well, actually, Sean mentioned this, which is to say that the House is actually passing bills now that the Senate already agreed to. You know, there had been a deal, as he pointed out. So it's now a question of shifting public support. It is interesting because in past shutdowns, President Clinton, for example, you know, wanted the public to feel the effects of the shutdown as much as possible in order to force public pressure against Congress. I mean, this is back in, you know, the mid-90s when the big dispute was over cuts to Medicare and Medicaid. This time around, you know, the administration is using whatever tools it can to avoid the public feeling this pain, right? They're front-loading food stamp payments before that appropriation runs out. They're deciding that IRS workers are suddenly essential employees. They never have been before, and they're probably not legally, but they don't want to delay tax refunds that people will be upset about. National parks suddenly, where they have trash piling up.
I heard people are mailing trash to the president.
Well, all contributions to the general fund welcome, I guess. But I know there's a GoFundMe site for the wall, if any of your listeners are interested.
I have heard about that, yeah.
If I could add something, which I think is a little bit distinctive and also crucial to understanding what's going on now, is that most presidents speak about the general interest and they try to govern in the general interest. This president is much more concerned about his base. Indeed, he's a captive of it. He's a minority president to begin with, as we know. Got 45.8% of the vote, didn't get a plurality, certainly didn't get a majority, but he won the Electoral College. And ever since, he's been a captive of the minority. And that minority is reflected in the Republican primaries, absolutely. And so those are active Trump supporters, and they're controlling the Senate, which, of course, isn't representative in general of public opinion. And as you just heard, Congress passed these appropriation bills. There was a deal, overwhelming consensus on keeping the government open and funding the government for the foreseeable future. And then the president heard from his most ardent supporters and his most vocal supporters, disparaging him, Ann Coulter, Rush Limbaugh, that sort of folks. And he backed off. He backed off. He is responding to a minority of the public, and they are in charge.
I wonder now, Sean Theriault, let's bring you in again, because the midterm election obviously has brought in an unprecedented House. Many more women, many more people of color, 2 Native Americans. We've got Muslim representation. We've got scientist representation. If you were going to look at this now, and then again, you know, I like things in a historic context. Is this unprecedented?
I mean, we had to change the House rules so that a Muslim person could wear a headscarf on the House floor. I mean, at the point at which the fundamental rules of decorum on the House of Representatives have to be changed in order to be inclusive to the people who have been duly sent by the voters to the House of Representatives, suggests that the House that is meeting today is unprecedented in all sorts of these diversity dimensions that you discussed. People like to talk about the new Democrats coming in, and if they're, you know, there's some really liberal ones and some folks who won in Trump districts who are going to be more moderate or conservative. And what I would say is true across the board, and I think this is even true with a lot of the new House Republicans, is that these folks want to solve problems. They've seen the American government over the last 2 years, and they've been frustrated. And so quite apart from ideology, they want to solve problems. And so I would expect the House to become really a fascinating institution to watch here over these next 2 years. I would think that this infectious spirit is going to transcend to the Senate. And so I suspect that we won't see a whole lot of new laws, but I think we're going to see a new spirit of cooperation and problem solving emerge from the House.
And we haven't had that in a long time, have we, Sean Theriault?
No, we haven't, because the House and the rules as they are in the House say that a majority party, so long as it has one more vote, can really ram a lot of stuff through. I think the precarious nature with which Nancy Pelosi reclaims the speakership has suggested that there's a new dynamic at play where this problem-solving caucus is going to play a bigger role. And I think, quite apart from the people who signed up for this caucus, I think that spirit is there among a lot of these new members who've been elected.
Mark Peterson, what would you add to that?
I think I want to go back to the Senate in that context, which is going to be really interesting to see what Mitch McConnell does, given what Sean just said about the House. McConnell's in a very, he's one of the craftiest and perhaps one of the most cynical politicians to ever be in such a role, but he's extremely skilled at it. And he's got to figure out, given what's happened in the House, a pathway forward, not only as George mentioned, is the Republicans have a bunch of senators that have to worry about being primaried if they get off the reservation with Donald Trump, but they also have a problem that the Democrats had in this last midterm. Republicans have a version of it going forward, which is in the next two rounds, they have more vulnerable seats up. And so those senators are looking both at the primary role that they have to face. And they are also looking at the general election. And right now, the general election is not going to look too favorable for them. And so threading that needle on the Senate side is going to be really important. And just to give you a sense of how bizarre the Senate is representationally now, in the 2018 midterm election, Donald Trump claimed great victory because the Republicans picked up a couple of seats in the Senate, and they did indeed, and that's very significant. It's going to have consequences for judicial nominations and the like. But in the popular vote for the Senate, the Republicans got killed. They lost by something like 20 percentage points. Now, some of that's because out here in California, we managed to have only two Democrats running for the Senate. And so millions of votes that would have gone to a Republican Senate candidate did not get added to the till.
But damn that Constitution.
Yes. But nonetheless, the Republicans managed to gain seats while losing any touch to the American public in a pretty sweeping way. And it's likely to be even more intense in those terms going into the next election. How Mitch McConnell figures that out, I don't know. I've kind of described him as being in political hiding right now because he doesn't really know. All he knows right now is to protect a set of his fellow colleagues in Republican ranks thinking about the primary side. But I don't know how they figured out the general election side.
Before I move off the Senate, Sean Theriault, why don't you respond to that? Would you agree with that assessment?
Oh, I agree with everything about that assessment. It's that threading that needle. And I would just add just one additional slight nuance here. And that's that the primary comes before the general. And so if you don't survive the primary, you're never on the general election ballot. And so while we can think of them as having an eye towards that general election where they don't want to be too far outside the mainstream, they'll never get that choice. And thus, if right now they bend their knee at the altar of Donald Trump and the type of politics that he practices.
So let's go back now to this idea of, you know, the government overall. George, I think this was from your work where you said that presidents who acceded power at all did not fare very well with voters. Now, Trump has not acceded power, but we're all saying here that he's weak. So what does that mean for him?
Well, he is weak in terms of his ability to govern by getting support of others. And so that means he's highly dependent on his discretionary powers, as Andy was talking about. And that allows you to do certain kinds of things. It's allowed him to, in my opinion, diminish protection for the environment and a range of other matters, particularly in the regulatory area. It's allowed him to do what we all have heard about in immigration, and at least to try to do in immigration. But it also doesn't provide you a statutory basis for long-term change. It doesn't provide you the ability to do a lot of other things. It doesn't provide you the ability to appropriate money. We'll put the national emergency aside for just a second on that. And so when he sends up a budget and it gets largely ignored, even by his own party, because it's often so absurd. I think the president frequently doesn't have any idea what's in the budget, but I can't say that for absolute certain, but I think I'm right about that. So that means that ultimately the president is not engaged in the normal give and take of American government, and that's how American government is designed to work. It's purposefully inefficient, and that's why we have what every school child learns as checks and balances. And so you've got to try to overcome the checks. And the president is not skilled at that, basically, in any fashion.
Yeah, and hasn't been throughout his life, has always been just a bully, in essence. And
well, that's right. I have labeled some of my writings, you know, the bully in the pulpit.
Yes, I saw that one. That was great.
Yes, that he tries to demean and diminish his opponents as opposed to engaging with them. And of course, you expect him to disagree, and that's fine. That's perfectly fine. And you would like them to negotiate and cut a deal. And instead, the president just is not able to do that. So right now we have a situation where the president is saying, I want to add something to the consensus that's out there. I want something. And we just had an election and people overwhelmingly rejected my view on immigration. And I want it anyhow. So I'm going to shut the government down. Well, that's not really effective governing.
And I think it's actually even worse than what George so ably articulated. Not only is President Trump left with having to, in a sense, try things unilaterally, but he also has no skill or capacity at recruiting people who can give him at least some wherewithal in the administrative side of government to get these things done well, or at least get them done in a way that will allow them to be effective in his own terms. He's managed to surround himself with a really much lower tier quality of people in government. He has now scared off a number of people who at least seem to be the kind of folks that you would traditionally have in a Republican, an effective, smart Republican administration. And so now he doesn't even have the capacity for unilateral action in a way that he might if he were able to surround himself with more and to listen and use a set of people who are more competent, more experienced, and more skilled maneuvering through the administrative side of the state.
You're listening to The Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're talking with four distinguished professors about the power of the presidency and the new Congress and what might transpire. I know we're seeing some investigations coming out of the Congress. Sean Thurial, is this something you can speak to? Like, what are we seeing now right out of the box, and where do you expect it to go?
Right now, I would say the Democrats are pretty measured in the investigations, in part just because the government shutdown is the big story in Washington, D.C. right now. So I think until we see the government back open, I think that you're likely not to hear much on the investigation front, at least in the public. That doesn't mean the committee staffers aren't working behind the scenes, getting ready to launch some of these investigations. But at this point, we're still working on committee assignments. We're still doing the background work that is necessary before launching these investigations. And quite frankly, right now, the only story in town is the government shutdown.
I was just seeing if somebody was going to jump in on that. Mark Peterson,
well,
you
actually,
didn't
I'm
jump
happy.
In.
Can I, this is Andy. I wonder if I can jump in for a second.
Yes.
On a couple of these points. You know, I think Sean is right. You know, we're going to see investigations. There's some recent work by Doug Kreiner and Eric Schickler, which suggests that historical investigations have, in fact, been pretty successful at their political purpose, right? There's sometimes a substantive purpose, of course, in terms of changing laws or changing the behavior of the administration. But there's also, you know, often a political purpose, and that will tend to, you know, be designed to drive down the popularity of the president or, you know, in the case of Mrs. Clinton with the Benghazi investigations, you know, other members of the administration. And that can work, especially, though, where it gains bipartisan hearing. And that, of course, is the big question, right? Whether Republicans, I thought Sean perhaps was optimistic about the prospect for bipartisanship, and maybe that isn't meant to apply to the investigatory side anyway, but it'll be interesting to see perhaps with Mr. Mueller's report whether that begins to give more, you know, bipartisan meat on those bones. On Mark's point about competent administrators, I think that's absolutely right. A sort of weird bonus for the president at having chosen amazingly incompetent people at Interior and EPA, for example, both of whose leaders are now gone already under very dark ethical clouds. You know, their deputies are actually quite competent, and they're now the acting people there. They are also former lobbyists for the fossil fuels industry. But that, you know, that doesn't mean they're not competent at what they want to do in terms of the regulatory arena. So, you know, it will, you know, these things take a lot of time, and you have to have a lot of, you know, substantive backup to change past regulation. It can be done. And we guess it does also remain to be seen how much time the Trump administration will have to do it.
If I could, Maria, in Sean's comment about the all the focus is on the partial shutdown of government, in some ways that might actually be advantageous to the House Democrats right now on the investigative front, because they are still in the process of organizing the committees, still in the process of hiring the kinds of staff you need to do the full-scale investigation. They're beginning to put together letters to send to administrative agencies requesting information. That's all going to take a while. And there's probably a sense among many in the public and certainly in the progressive base, they want to see it now. They want to see things happening now that are probably unrealistic just given how the mechanics actually have to work. So the shutdown, in a way, is providing a nice curtain. A lot can happen behind that curtain. People aren't focused on it right now. And when the government is finally reopened, presumably not years from now, but in the relatively near future, the Democratic committees will have been primed to move forward on the investigative fronts. And they are being very careful about where they're going with that. They're not going to rush into across-the-board investigation. It seems as though they're really targeting what they're going to do, and they're sequencing out that activity in some sense of being responsive to where the Mueller investigation is, when it might report, and not getting into that territory and moving to other parts of the domain that have not been thoroughly pursued by the Republicans previously.
Which would you say are the most significant of those?
In this administration, there's so much, it's like shooting fish in a barrel. I don't know what I would put first. I think, though, that probably what's going to be really effective is going to be pretty widespread. It's going to include the cabinet members who had to leave under an ethical cloud. It's going to include potentially a Trump family members in the Trump organization and their roles there. There will be eventually an opportunity and opening for whatever comes out of the Mueller investigation. So all of that, it's really going to be the summation of it all together that's going to be pretty striking when it finally occurs.
George Edwards, what would you say about that?
I was just going to add very quickly that it comes back to your question of you know, people who don't trust government, because I think the most effective aggregation of these investigations will suggest that you know, President Trump is a swamp dweller, right? And his appointees are swamp dwellers. He's not draining the swamp. He's part of the problem. You know, the emoluments question, conflicts of interest, down to, you know, expensive government flights for your family. I think all of that goes to the impression that, you know, they voted for change and they got someone even worse.
And there have been so many investigations gradually coming out from organizations like ProPublica showing the extent of the use of the public to enrich oneself. It's just, it seems it never ends. But I wonder also, so if in fact those are violations that are severe enough for the Democrats to feel it's okay to raise the I question, the impeachment question, and I don't know if it will or not reach that level for them, it also seems like we've got a stacked Supreme Court that is party hacks for the most part. Am I just cynical at this point?
I think you're being, I'll put it this way. I would not call them party hacks, but I think what you're tapping into is a worry that all of us institutionalists have, and which, by the way, Chief Justice Roberts has, which is the Supreme Court seems to be emerging as just another institution that has a partisan divide. And in this case, the partisan divide favors the Republicans. And it's losing rapidly that aura of independence, that aura of being a distinctly different kind of institution. During the George W. Bush administration, when the president was often very unpopular and Congress was desperately unpopular, public had enormously high regard for the Supreme Court, which is always ironic in a democratic system, that the institution that has the greatest public endorsement is the institution most removed from the public, over which the public has the least capacity for influence and accountability. Those numbers have really come down now. And there is a real risk that the court will lose its credibility and be thought of as simply a partisan legislature, and the only difference is they're there for life.
Yeah, I tend to fall into the category of that they are part of the party coalition. Not always. Certainly, like you said, Roberts has tried to some degree to at least vote once, maybe twice. But I do have a sense, if you look at the histories of each justice, that they have come out of the party apparatus and continue to behave in that way, at least the current one. And I don't know that I would say that across the board. I'm not a Supreme Court historian by any stretch. George Edwards, what would you say?
First of all, Supreme Court justices have from the beginning come out of party apparatus, even before we really had a full party apparatus. So they were associated with particular points of view, partisan points of view. So there's nothing, that's not unusual. Moreover, I would say that Trump's, for example, his two appointees to the Supreme Court are very well qualified. Now, we may disagree with their orientation, their views on particular issues. And of course, they've been as vague as possible in the hearings on their confirmations. But nevertheless, they are not party hacks. I think Mark is absolutely right. There is a danger to the polity as a whole. They are seen as party hacks. If they are seen as just one more partisan institution, then that doesn't do a lot for the rule of law in America. And that has been under challenge by the president on a number of ways, and is challenging the Justice Department, is challenging the FBI, is challenging the Mueller investigation, and really a range of other activities that the president really has posed a challenge to the rule of law. And I worry about that just from the standpoint of the long term of the polity. I do think that there is a big issue there.
If I could just jump in for a second, and I can't believe that I'm about to do this because I never defend Article 3, the court system. But I think that there's no one that understands the place of the Supreme Court in American politics better than John Roberts. And I think that he recognizes that the reason that the court has any credibility and can speak its mind and get its way whatsoever is because the massive amount of reserve that the American public feels towards the court. And so if the American public starts feeling that the court is just as bad as those Republicans in the House or the Senate, then the court has absolutely nothing going its way and no power to enforce its decisions. The person that knows that best in Washington, D.C. is John Roberts. And so I think that even when you see what we would interpret as partisan opinions coming down, they're going to be so narrowly crafted and apply to that case and perhaps that case only, that in order for John Roberts to kind of protect the reserve that the court does have among the American public.
Andy, would you like to respond to that as well?
I think they're right about that. I mean, it is true, though, that the votes on the court are predictable. As George said, go back to John Marshall, right? The most famous Chief Justice statue in the hallway of the Supreme Court, right? He was a Federalist Party hack, if you want to put it that way, appointed at the last second of the Adams administration. So there is certainly a long history in people appointing folks whose vote they hope they will have when they need it later. One interesting thing about the current court, and this goes actually across the appointments, is sort of a past history of working in the executive branch. And I'm just curious to see over time how that will come through, right? Various people who've worked in, certainly Roberts and Alito and Elena Kagan, all folks who have worked extensively in the executive branch before they went to the judiciary. And, is there a sympathy there for expansive executive power over the course of their decisions? I'd be interested to see that.
I think that's a really important question.
It's a crucial question, but if there's a small ray of optimism on that score, I think those members of the court do have very expansive views of executive power in the Constitution. But I'm not sure that's going to translate into support for this particular president and this particular president's actions when those actions really go so far out of the bounds of normal expectations, even in a broadly defined unitary theory of the executive that a few of these folks have brought to the court. And it could be we might see, for instance, depending on what cases get to the court that involve the president's own actions, we might have some surprises from Justice Kavanaugh despite his owing President Trump a great deal in getting onto the court, I think there's going to be a limit to how far he'll let that go in his permitting the kind of free, out-of-control activities on the part of the court, President Trump.
I'm sorry, which justice do you think?
Kavanaugh.
And why Kavanaugh in particular?
Well, Kavanaugh is the one who came through the biggest test. He had Donald Trump standing behind him, not just supporting him as a justice, but supporting him through the whole challenge on sexual assault and harassment, and in a sense turned that whole enterprise into the most partisan, not only in terms of nomination, but after the justice was confirmed by the Senate, had essentially a partisan speech in support of Justice Kavanaugh when the photo op swearing in was being done. It really was a tainted process in ways beyond others in the past.
I suppose that was part of what drove my, you know, concern about Hackdom was that latest appointment, partly because I have tracked his votes across and his prior to the court life in the previous administrations and, you know, doing the investigation on Clinton. And so I suppose that was part of, and I recognize he's one of nine, but it definitely taints my view, Kavanaugh in particular. Sean, this is to bring you back in again. I know you've done some work with women legislators and the effect of having women legislators. And I think this is the greatest number of female legislators that we have now. What can you tell us from the work you've done that we might be able to expect?
So it is the most women that we've had serving in the Capitol, both in the House and in the Senate, and by more than a little. We've seen incremental growth over the last 20 or 30 years. If you look at that over time, the 2018 election is going to look different than the elections that just immediately preceded it. What my work, and this is co-authored with Jennifer Lawless, shows is that we might expect the House and the Senate to be a more collegial place. We know that women put a greater emphasis on getting along with their colleagues, not only their female colleagues, but also their male colleagues. But yet we haven't yet seen that transition into them voting differently or co-sponsoring bills in a different way. So they still engage the legislative process just as the men that preceded them engaged the legislative process. And they're no different on lots of those legislative types of dimensions, but they are different in terms of the collegial stuff. So the amount of time that they'll go to a Secret Santa gathering of senators across the aisle, or their willingness to participate in a softball game with members from the other party. They are better on those dimensions, but yet we haven't seen it have much of a legislative effect yet. And it could just be that there needs to be enough women so that the institution transforms itself. And in similar to the argument that I make in the Gingrich Senators, where one or two of these folks coming over from the House couldn't transform the Senate, but it was the fact that you're getting two or three or four with each succeeding cycle so that at some point they just dominate the Republican conference. So it could be that we're at a tipping point now. I suspect that we're not, but we're closer than we were before the 2018 election.
I make one quick observation about this. For all the wonders of the election results and the really quite comparatively to the past, huge numbers of women coming into particularly the House, put those numbers together and the United States Congress percentage of women is far below that for the other advanced democracies in the world. It's below the average for the world in general. It's below the average for low-income countries in the world, for the countries that are not as politically as advanced as we are. So we still are far back in having the kind of representation in our legislature that we would expect it in this day and age, and also to get across that threshold that Sean just talked about.
I seem to remember one publication about women legislators. When you have, I don't think it was a critical mass, but when you have more women legislators, you do tend to have women's issues legislated more frequently. And one of the concerns, I suppose, that drove them was the way women were treated in the public sphere by Trump as a candidate and then even a bit as a president. So I was wondering if we're going to see women's issues come up in legislation.
I think that we will, but I think a lot of those studies that found that effect is when you go from a very small number of women to just a few more. And so certainly, again, like we have had a marked increase, But we've had around 20% women. And so a lot of those women's issues that previously weren't discussed have already been entered into the political fray and on the political agendas. The one thing that I would say, though, about this class that was elected in 2018 is that you have many different people from all different backgrounds. And that's true for men and for women. And so anytime that you get new blood in an institution, then you can expect new issues to arise that, quite frankly, the people there 2 years ago hadn't ever thought about because they hadn't spent the life in the shoes of those people that are there now. And so I certainly would expect some different issues to arise, and not just women's issues. I think that we might see incremental changes there, but some things that quite frankly haven't been part of politics because we haven't had legislators like those that now are serving in the House.
Just a note, though, I mean, it is true that we have a much more diverse group of legislators and of female legislators, but actually the Republican caucus got less diverse. So while we part of the reason the number of women legislators didn't increase as much as sort of the popular press suggests is that a lot of women, female Republicans lost or left. Mia Love did not give the president enough love, according to him. So she lost. She has suggested that was not the reason. But in general, you know, you have a big caucus of female legislators, but almost all of them are Democratic. And that will in itself shift the kind of policy that group pursues.
I would add one other thing, if I might, and that is that if the Supreme Court, should make a decision which rejects abortion, and it's possible, they're certainly going to be asked to, then all hell is going to break loose. And of course, you'd expect that the women, both the House and the Senate, will play a leading role in trying to respond to that.
I just don't know what they would be able to do in that case.
Well, it won't be simple, but for future nominees to the Supreme Court would be certainly the focus of even more attention than it is now. There may be issues that you could deal with through appropriations. I don't know. I mean, the battlegrounds will go to the states if the Supreme Court should overturn Roe v. Wade. And I'm not suggesting that they are. I don't know. But yeah. I'm just saying that these folks in both the House and the Senate will be playing leading roles in response to that.
I wanted to check if there are final thoughts, anybody really burning thoughts that they wanted to state. Mark Peterson?
We have this extraordinary situation now emerging in the elected officials of the United States in which one party in the legislature, because of these demographic shifts in the electoral process, has become a party of essentially white males, and white males from typically more rural areas of the country. And the other party has become the party of incredible diversity, a record number of women, record number of African Americans, record number of Latinos, the first two Native American representatives, with female representatives, I should say, and two Muslim representatives. So these parties are really divided in deep demographic ways as well as in policy terms. And one of the things that's happened with abortion, like other issues on the environment and elsewhere, is what used to be an issue that cut across the two parties has now really been anchored in one party or the other. So you have a distinctly anti-abortion party, the Republican Party, a distinctly pro-choice party, the Democratic Party, and you line that up with all these things. I really worry about what that means for the nature of political discourse, engagement, the capacity for learning and hearing and listening to one another and moving forward in a more cohesive and civil way in American politics.
Sean? The contrast between what he just said and what the Republican autopsy told us after Mitt Romney lost in 2012, right? So think about how much politics has just changed in that 6 years. And so think about where we are now and where we might be in 2024. And then it could be, again, a world that is completely unrecognizable, at least from where we are today.
If I could just build on something George said earlier that fits into this. You know, President Trump was elected with far from a majority of the vote. He's been polling in Gallup and other polling well below that number. He's an extraordinarily unpopular president, especially given the strength of the economy. Sort of a generic president, given economic conditions in the U.S. right now, should be 55, 60% probably. And what's been interesting You know, George in his work has talked about facilitating as president, actually looking for where there is consensus to be built and then leading the country towards that. The president has chosen to do the opposite, to actually double down on that 39-40% of the public that seems consistently with him rather than to try to build a majority. There's nothing for him to facilitate. His preferences are not popular. So as long as he continues down that road, you know, appealing to the divisions that Mark mentioned, I don't think he's going to be successful.
George, that leaves you.
I agree with all my colleagues. I think I've said everything I have to say on this one.
Well, I thank you all so very much for being with us here on the Scholar's Circle. It's been a great pleasure hosting you. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Great to be with you. Thank you.
Thanks.
Andrew Rudulovich is the Thomas Brackett Reed Professor of Government at Bowdoin College. He's the author of Managing the President's Program, Presidential Leadership and Legislative Policy Formation, and also The New Imperial Presidency. George C. Edwards is a University Distinguished Professor Emeritus of Political Science and the Jordan Chair in Presidential Studies at Texas A&M University. His books include On Deaf Ears, The Limits of the Bully Pulpit, The Strategic President, Persuasion and Opportunity in Presidential Leadership, and Predicting the Presidency, The Potential of Persuasive Leadership. Mark Peterson is Professor of Public Policy and Political Science in the Department of Public Policy's Luskin School of Public Affairs and also Professor of Law at UCLA School of Law. He's the author of Legislating Together, The White House and Capitol Hill from Eisenhower to Reagan. He's also the editor of Healthy Markets, The New Competition in Medical Care, and he's co-editor of the volume Institutions of American Democracy, the Executive Branch. Sean Theriault is a professor in the Department of Government at the University of Texas, Austin. He is the author of The Power of the People, Congressional Competition, Public Attention, and Voter Retribution, Party Polarization in Congress, and The Gingrich Senators, The Roots of Partisan Warfare in Congress. And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Arasyan, Melissa Chiprin, Anais Amin, Mike Hurst, and Tim Page, most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.